Hello, everybody. This week, thanks to the fine folk over on Patreon who voted for it, we're going to look at five ambitious but ultimately somewhat rubbish naval ideas. Now, the criteria that was specified in the more detailed description of that was essentially an idea that looked fairly good on paper, but ultimately, thanks to either technological limitations or flaws in implementation, or perhaps just a strategic flaw in the entire doctrine behind its use, turned out to be basically not worth the time and money spent on them. So, in no particular order, we're going to start off with the cruiser submarine, specifically in the realm of the cruiser submarine when it comes to attacking warships. Now, the reason I make that distinction is because cruiser submarines as a whole were simply the idea for a very large, very long distance submarine that would fulfill essentially the role or some of the roles of a cruiser, i.e. sail long distances and, in the classic cruiser mission, interdict enemy commerce. However, cruiser submarines came in a wide variety of flavors. You have vessels like Nautilus, Narwhal, and Argonaut to varying degrees in the US in the early 1920s. You have, of course, the X-1, built in the UK. Technically speaking, the K-class, the French Surcouf, and a whole list of others, some of which were built and many, many more of which were considered, particularly, unsurprisingly, by the Germans. Now, apart from big, long distance and able to interdict commerce, the other thing that showed up in almost every single cruiser submarine design was lots of big guns of varying calibers. Big guns in terms of big guns for a submarine, of course. And the reason for this was twofold. Firstly, torpedoes were big, heavy weapons. And even on what for the time, mostly looking at the interwar period, maybe late World War I, were very large submarine hulls, you still could only carry a certain number of torpedoes. And when you looked at the planned range and therefore operational period of these kinds of submarines, it became very clear that unless you could come up with some form of resupply at sea, the submarine would be very likely to expend most or all of its torpedoes long before it was in any danger of running out of fuel. And so some other system that could take on at least merchant ships was desired. The other factor was that, well, being very large, these cruiser submarines would be operating mostly on the surface, diving when necessary, but being very large and very optimized for surface running, most of them would be relatively slow to dive. Again, not all, but most. And their underwater handling, again, most of the time, would not be particularly great compared to some of these smaller and more agile subs. And therefore, there was a reasonable chance that if they spotted an enemy warship, whether that be an escort or a generic enemy warship on the surface, that vessel might well have a chance to start shooting at them. Or if it was part of a convoy, well, escorts could be anywhere. And so the idea was very rapidly taken on board, well, the cruiser submarine should be able to shoot back. But if it's going to shoot back, well, then in theory that means it's being shot at, which means it should have some form of protection, and so some cruiser submarines were even designed with armor. But since you were talking about a submarine which, generally speaking, wasn't going to be able to carry that many guns, you had a similar problem to that which confronted battleship secondary batteries. If you were going to shoot at something, you wanted any single hit you landed to be pretty devastating and potentially knock your target out of action. Now, with some cruiser submarine designs, the Navy in question avoided this pitfall. They simply decided that, okay, well, we're just not going to engage particularly large enemy warships. We're going to keep the gun systems at a level where they are rapid fire and lethal enough to put down merchant ships, maybe the occasional small unarmored escort, a sloop or a corvette or something like that. But anything bigger than that, well, this is what torpedoes are for the most part. And so you have designs like X-1 with its twin 5.2-inch gun mounts, or some of the US cruiser designs like the Narwhal and Nautilus with a couple of open-deck 6-inch guns. The intention, both in stated strategy and just looking at the subs, was quite clearly to only ever really engage something that couldn't particularly shoot back, or shoot back very effectively, aka a merchant ship, or something that you could put down pretty quickly, even with a relatively limited armament, such as a small escort. There was a desire to fit really big guns, 8-inch guns being very common, because in the interwar period, that was the largest you were going to get on a ship that wasn't going to be classified as a capital ship, but also with the size of submarines, unless you happen to be designing the M-class, anything bigger than that tended to be a little impractical on the hull size that was possible anyway. And with these guns, especially with some of the designs which called for 8 or 9 such weapons, the idea was to just straight up fight it out with anything that wasn't a battleship. And as we mentioned, to this end, in some cases, some of the designs were armoured, but not all. The majority didn't have any armour at all. Now, the reason why this is an ambitious but rubbish idea is that, to a certain degree, you can see why it would make sense. It's very stealthy. The submarine can't fire quite as far because, well, it, even when surfaced, sits very low to the water, it physically can't see as far, even with some kind of pop-up fire control rangefinder system. But being a submarine, it obviates that range issue by just operating slightly closer. Ideally, by unleashing a surprise attack, it could get off its first salvos while the enemy ship was still getting itself ready and or aiming the guns at the submarine. The submarine was, in theory, a smaller target, so it should be slightly harder to hit. And if things got a little bit too hot, like other friends of the ship in question showing up, the submarine could just dive and disappear off into the depths, perhaps with a parting salvo of torpedoes to discourage pursuit. But there were a laundry list of fundamental problems with the idea. Even the armoured schemes didn't have particularly thick armour, so if you were fighting anything particularly substantial, like, say, a cruiser, there was a decent chance that those shells were probably going to go through your armour anyway, and even then the armour didn't cover the entire length of the sub, which leads us on to another point, which was that if you put holes in a cruiser, or even a destroyer, there are fairly significant portions of the above water portion of a warship where a single shell hit or two actually doesn't fundamentally change that ship's ability to fight. There's an awful lot of mess decks, crew quarters, and so forth that simply aren't all that vital to a ship's operation as a fighting unit. So blow big chunks out of the ship and you might not actually significantly impair its fighting capability at all. The same is not true for a submarine. Even a cruiser submarine, the pressure hull occupies by far the largest volume of the sub, and even if parts of that pressure hull contain the mess, the crew quarters, the galley, etc., any significant breach in the pressure hull, or indeed potentially just damage to it, either prevents you from diving outright or significantly restricts your diving depth in the case of a dent or two. And so any real hit to a cruiser submarine would at the very least mission kill it, if not actually kill it, because again, submarines don't tend to deal very well with flooding as compared to surface warships, which have a lot more spare volume. And yes, there is the casing and so forth. There are small parts which you could hit, which wouldn't necessarily breach the pressure hull, but one, if you did hit them, the shell presumably would explode, and if it did so, fragments could pierce the pressure hull. But you also tended to find there was an awful lot of stuff exterior to the pressure hull, but within the casing, which was actually still vital to the submarine's operation. It could be spare torpedoes, it could be air ducts, it could be ballast tanks, saddle tanks, all sorts of things. So essentially, a hit on a submarine with any substantial shell, assuming you're fighting a substantial escort warship or just warship generally, is at the absolute minimum going to be a major inconvenience, most likely a mission kill, very possibly just a straight-up actual kill. So in an exchange of fire, a cruiser submarine, no matter its armament, is almost certainly going to come off worse. But there was another issue. Now, remember we said in case of even a pop-up fire control rangefinder platform, a cruiser sub couldn't shoot as far as a regular warship. Well, even if you had that kind of extension going on, the simple fact was a submarine, even a submarine optimized more for surface warfare than underwater warfare, simply was not as stable a firing platform as an actual surface warship. You would have significantly more roll and significantly more pitch, and that would mean that if you had stuck a poor old guy up in a rangefinder on the end of a telescoping pole mast to give you some semblance of range, he's going to be being swung back and forth in all but the absolute flattest of seas like he's on a fairground ride. And that is going to severely compromise his ability to do anything more than hold on, and very definitely compromise his ability to give you anything like accurate fire control readings. So as a gun platform, a cruiser submarine is also pretty terrible. And on top of all that, due to their limited size, the gun mountings, whether they be mountings or turrets, would also be relatively cramped on anything with any substantial bite. So let's say guns above about 6 inches. And that meant that even if you were engaged with, say, an 8-inch cruiser, and you were one of the more ambitious designs that could match them gun barrel for gun barrel, your rate of fire almost certainly would not be able to match them simply because of the cramped conditions of your gun turret versus the enemy's gun turrets. And a lot of compromises had to be made with the design of these larger cruiser subs with lots of and or big guns, as well as potentially in some cases armor, that took them further and further away from decent underwater performance. So you ended up with a vessel that theoretically could take on larger warships, but would almost certainly lose to them in a straight-up gunfight, and also was a fairly poor actual submarine, and therefore would be much easier to hunt down and destroy underwater by various enemy escorts, and thus falls into the ambitious but rubbish naval category. Next up, we have a sort of combined category, the torpedo cruiser - torpedo battleship, aka a torpedo-dedicated warship any significant size larger than a destroyer. Now, again, on paper, these sort of things seemed to hold a degree of attraction. After all, torpedoes per hit were the single most devastating weapons available at sea, but submarines, for the most part, suffered from speed issues when it came to intercepting an actual battle fleet, and destroyers, while not lacking in the speed department, were highly vulnerable, and in a lot of early cases also had relatively few torpedoes. If you only have 2, 3, 4 torpedoes, then even if you somehow dodge and weave through a storm of secondary battery fire to launch your weapons, the chances of actually scoring a hit, except by massive, overwhelming numbers of vessels attacking, was pretty small. And destroyers, in large part due to their small size, also had fairly short ranges. So if you were the Grand Fleet and the High Seas Fleet going up against each other over the reaches of the North Sea, it was just about manageable, but even then you couldn't afford to go out for very long. Whereas if you were going to fight a battle across the length of the Atlantic, or worse still, the Pacific, you'd have to be very, very inventive as to how you were going to get your destroyers to the battlefield without huge amounts of additional logistics involved. Whereas, if you stuck even more torpedoes on something like a cruiser or a battleship, then you would have a vessel that, by its nature, could at least keep up with, if not be faster than, the regular battle line, would be able to deliver absolutely punishing waves of torpedo attack from a single point source, and would be seaworthy and long-range enough to keep up with the battle fleet. As well as protected enough, in terms of both armament and armor, i.e. guns, as well as armor, to actually hold off or even counter direct enemy efforts to deal with you before you could launch your torpedoes. But depending on the design, either the implementation or the attempted implementation proved to be a lot more questionable. Torpedo battleships weren't actually built, while torpedo cruisers to a certain degree were. Now, the fundamental problem was that your biggest and most valuable targets, and therefore the ones you were going to expend most of your torpedoes at, tended to be the enemy battleships. So while a torpedo cruiser did offer an upgrade in firepower, range, and technically speaking survivability compared to a destroyer, it was of course also considerably more expensive, and being a cruiser still had basically nothing in the way of protecting itself from battleship gunfire. Now sure, a 4-inch, 5-inch, or 6-inch secondary battery gun wasn't likely to stop a torpedo cruiser, assuming it didn't hit in the magazines, with a single hit. However, the torpedo cruiser was a much larger target, generally speaking was also going to be somewhat slower than a destroyer, and, perhaps more importantly, if you were going after a battleship, it was now a big enough target and a big enough of a threat to merit the attention of the battleship's main guns. And yeah, you might shrug off a 5 or a 6 inch shell hit, you were not going to shrug off an 11 or a 12 inch shell hit. And even if you could fit a torpedo cruiser with powerful enough engines so that it could keep up with destroyers, so hitting high 20s or low 30s of knots, depending on the exact time period, it was still just a bigger and therefore easier to hit target, and would probably be the subject of fire from other cruisers and possibly other capital ships as well as the one you were targeting, in a straight-up fight against another cruiser, perhaps on a more typical cruiser mission away from the battle fleet. Because of the high number of torpedoes it had on board, it would have had to sacrifice gun armament, so it would lose in a straight-up gunfight and wouldn't be able to close down with a similar speed cruiser. And again, due to being a somewhat bigger target and most likely somewhat slower, it was also very vulnerable to being hit by enemy destroyers with their own torpedoes. And with the large number of torpedoes on board, there would not only be significant risks of flooding from single devastating hits, but also potentially magazine explosions from the large number of torpedoes, the large amount of compressed air, and the regular magazines. The torpedo battleship, championed in the States, was an attempt to solve at least the armor portion of this by, well, upgrading the size to a battleship, upgrading the armor to that of a battleship, and in some designs perhaps even more than the regular line battleship, with the idea being that then the vessel would have the speed to at least match, possibly slightly exceed the battle line, could sail with the battle line, might, depending on the design, have its own guns to just straight up engage in the battle line, but could also break towards the enemy line and then unleash ridiculous numbers of torpedoes. The idea, of course, being that as it closed in, its armor would help to keep the ship intact, or intact enough that it would reach a launch range for its payload. The basic problem, though, was again, well, if you see a big enemy battleship, perhaps of a slightly weird design, breaking off from its formation and charging at you, it doesn't take a genius to work out what it's probably going to try and do, and therefore you're going to concentrate your fire on it anyway. And even if it is well protected, it's probably going to be mission killed enough in terms of cutting its speed or its agility or so forth to make it virtually impossible to launch your torpedoes. And all of this circled around one very major issue that, for the most part, throughout the late 19th and early 20th century held true, and that simply was that torpedoes had a limited range compared to guns. Now, torpedoes' range did continue to improve, this is true, but weirdly it ended up almost paralleling the increases in naval gunnery ranges. So in the 1870s and 1880s, and perhaps even into the 1890s, torpedoes had a range that could be measured in the hundreds of yards. But ships' guns, while their effective fighting range could often sometimes be in the high hundreds of yards, could, in theory at least, reach out to at least 1,000 to 1,500 yards, often around about double the effective range of an actual torpedo. And that was before you accounted for the fact that a torpedo, obviously being much slower than a shell, had to be aimed considerably ahead of its target, and therefore would have to actually travel a considerably greater distance than the simple distance between the two ships would suggest, whereas a shell, with very slight variations, didn't really have to travel all that much further than the direct distance between the two ships. And then torpedoes came along that could now crack into the four figures. They could take themselves 1,000 yards, 1,500 yards, 2,000, 3,000 yards, just in time for gun ranges, thanks to the invention of rangefinders and centralized fire control, to start hitting 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 yards. And then torpedo ranges increased again. They could now go 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 yards, and gun ranges went up to 12,000, 15,000, or 20,000 yards. And so you're faced with a never-increasing gap, which a torpedo cruiser or torpedo battleship would have to cross without being able to use its torpedoes while under fire from enemy warships, and then it would only just be at the very extremity of its effective range. To get a really effective salvo off, it would have to cross still more distance to get into what might be described as closer point-blank range, and then it could fire. Even the vaunted Long Lance, with its extremely long range, especially for the time, could still only range out to what would be considered for heavy cruisers, standard battle ranges, and what would be for battleships, not close, but certainly approaching medium distance battle ranges, as battleships could engage at 20 to 25,000 yards comfortably, a little bit beyond that with difficulty. And while the optimal long-range setting for a long lance was around about this same distance, as we mentioned, with the long lance you had to fire considerably further ahead, which basic trigonometry then told you that your actual point-to-point range was somewhat less. And on top of that, the Japanese didn't actually try for torpedo cruisers or torpedo battleships in the classic late 19th, early 20th century sense. And so the torpedo cruiser and torpedo battleship fall into the ambitious but rubbish category in that, you know, in theory, yeah, decent idea, but the continuous evolution of ranges for both guns and torpedoes, along with the compromises you had to make to develop a torpedo cruiser or battleship, which ultimately was almost entirely just a battle line weapon, didn't have a huge amount of use outside of it, a bit like fire ships earlier in the centuries, just meant it was never really successfully implemented. And sticking with torpedoes, we're going to look at torpedo boat motherships. Now, these, again, a bit like a cruiser submarines, can be looked at in two ways. You have the ships that would eventually evolve into the destroyer tender, i.e. a mothership in terms of this is where the torpedo boats go to receive their fuel, to receive resupply, for crews to rest, etc., etc. Those are not the subject of this video. Those are actually relatively good ideas. What I'm referring to is a way to try and overcome the inherent limitations of torpedo boats in the late 19th century. Now, torpedo boats, even more so than destroyers, had exceptionally limited range and also very limited seakeeping capabilities in anything but moderate seas. This was, of course, a problem because it meant that, yes, you could have a ton of torpedo boats close in for harbour defence or coastal defence, but if your enemy was more than a couple of dozen miles off your own coastline, they were pretty useless. You could theoretically tow a bunch of them to some kind of overseas base, but then they were limited to operating within the radius of that overseas base, which, again, is not going to cover a huge amount of ocean. And that is, of course, assuming that that base has all the necessary spare parts and torpedoes, etc., etc., to maintain them. But the idea of a torpedo boat mothership was, well, you loaded all of that into a larger ship. You then put a series of massive davits, a bit like normal boat davits, but on a much larger scale, and craned your torpedo boats up on board. They may not be first-class torpedo boats, they might be second-class to reduce their size and therefore impact. You might also have some kind of launch ramp and have some stored internally to the ship. Whatever. The main point was, big ship carry lots of smaller torpedo boats. And then at the very minimum, this would allow you to take a self-contained torpedo boat squadron or half squadron pretty much anywhere in the world that you liked. And even if it was just an austere harbour, you could set up shop there with your torpedo boats because, hey, all the stuff that they needed could come from the mothership. But realistically, one of the main ambitions of these motherships was to be able to accompany the battle fleet, with the idea being not that they'd get themselves directly into the line of fire, but that you could then have a battle occurring anywhere in the open ocean, or perhaps on enemy coastlines just further away from harbours. And when battle was in the offing, the torpedo boat mothership would set down all its torpedo boats, and they would go motoring off happily with the battle fleet, engage in their torpedo attacks, and then come back to you, well, those that survived, and be craned on board safe for the journey home. But the implementation ran into a couple of rather insurmountable problems. Firstly, any kind of ship that was configured to be able to carry large amounts of supplies, plus torpedo boats, plus its own supplies and equipment, was by its nature going to be more mercantile in hull form than warship-like, and it would struggle immensely to keep up with anything but the slowest of pre-dreadnought battle fleets. And secondly, part of the issue, apart from range, was seakeeping, and it turned out that, well, if you took a bunch of torpedo boats out into the open ocean, and you obviously aren't necessarily going to be able to time exactly when your battles take place with regards to the weather, there was a very good chance that the seas would be too rough to operate the torpedo boats safely anyway. And the whole thing would be a very big target, especially if you were talking about a more average speed pre-dreadnought battle fleet, or indeed a dreadnought battle fleet, where the poor thing would almost certainly be left behind and be subject to attack by roving enemy warships, which it couldn't get away from. And so while it remained a decent concept on paper, the very few ships that were actually purchased with this idea at all very quickly found themselves converted into torpedo boat tenders, sometimes just by simply changing their use rather than altering anything else about the ship, rather than any kind of offensive platform, with only one potentially questionable success, which was one of the very earliest torpedo boat tenders, a Russian vessel, which in one of the many Russo-Turkish wars in the late 19th century could claim to have destroyed a target, specifically a Turkish warship, with one of its torpedo craft. Although this was acting much, much more as just a forward tender or depot ship in a more traditional manner, it wasn't deploying the torpedo boat out in the open sea because it had seen a target. Then we come on to rubber armor. Now you might think, hang on, that seems immediately silly, but not necessarily in the context that we're looking at, which is the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, and 1860s. Now, this broad heading of rubber armor comes in a variety of shapes and forms. You could just be talking about slabs of rubber. There was also a compound called camptulicon, which was a mixture of rubber and crushed cork. But essentially, they were relying on pretty much the same properties and mostly or entirely the same baseline material. And before you get your hopes up, no, the idea wasn't for the just sticking massive slabs of rubber on the side of a ship in place of wood or later iron and then hoping that enemy shots would bounce off with a resounding boing noise. Instead, the idea was actually surprisingly practical. It was noted that thinner sheets of iron, particularly in the era when they were looking at building iron warships as opposed to iron armoured warships, couldn't necessarily stop incoming rounds. And once it was realised that the performance of Nemesis over in China had been a little bit of an abnormality, and over in colder European waters, iron tended to shatter with a large amount of splinters, it was realised something would need to be done about that. Also, obviously, there would be a hole which needed to be dealt with. And while a more traditional backing of wood eventually became the default, for a while, these rubber products were a competitor. The idea being, as compared to wood, that rubber would tear when it was subject to a great force, like being hit by a solid shot. It would allow the shot to pass through. Okay, that wasn't great, but wood was going to fail fairly similarly anyway. But unlike wood, you wouldn't get splinters from the wood, so you would just have to deal with splinters from the iron, which hopefully the rubber would catch. And then, once the shot had passed through, because of the ductility of the rubber would just flow back into place. And for the most part, through a combination of its ductility, its stickiness, and its mass, seal the hole that had just come through. So there'd be a hole in your iron plating outside, but water really couldn't get in further because of the sealing nature of the rubber. And when initial tests were done in the 1830s and 1840s, it seemed at first that this was actually a fairly good idea. They even backed targets that were just representative of wooden ships with this rubber. And the first results showed that, yeah, the shot went through and then the hole sealed. So this is an advantage. Great, fantastic. And before you're asking, no, nobody did any flammability checks, which seems a bit odd, but yeah, that probably would have been a major downside if they'd checked for it. But nonetheless, the testing, however, ran into two much more immediate problems. The first one was that rubber, because in large part of its ductile nature, didn't offer the same kind of resistance even as wood. So when you were looking at iron plate, either just iron hull plating or later in other tests, iron armor plate, shot that struck and penetrated the iron and then went on into the backing material was sometimes stopped by the wood because it had lost a lot of energy, but was never stopped by the rubber. It just carried on straight through. And of course, yes, there was a risk of splintering with the wood, but if a shot had been stopped, this was a much better result than a shot that passed through, because a shot that had been stopped couldn't upset guns, start fires internally, or worse still, go on to strike the other side of the ship. That latter one being a fairly major concern, because it was found that even if a shot penetrated through iron and then wood, very often if it carried through a target and then struck the other side, representing essentially an exit wound, when it hit wood and then iron going out, the shot was very often stopped dead. It just didn't have the energy to continue on through. Whereas a shot that went through iron backed by some kind of rubber product not only went across the ship with considerably more energy and thus did more destruction to stuff in its way, but when it struck the other side, of course, starting off with more energy, would go straight through the rubber, using very little of its energy, and very often retained the energy to blow through the iron plating on the far side as well, although with very much reduced energy compared to when it initially penetrated on the engaged side. This very, very often meant that what it ended up blowing out, rather than being a nice, neat shell or shot-shaped hole in the side of the ship, tended to be a big, ragged hole, which was quite the negative. And so, from that perspective, the whole idea was a failure. There was then, in the US, a separate trial which looked at those earlier trials and went, okay, so that has not necessarily worked out too well, but what if we take the iron plating, whether that be, as we said, hull plating or armoured, with wooden backing, that's our standard now, but instead of putting the rubber on the inside, we put the rubber on the outside, on top of the iron plating, because we know it's not going to really afford any resistive value, but on the outside, it's not really doing that anyway, and it will still, in theory, provide the hole-plugging function that we really is the only benefit at this point. And so they did a bunch of tests for this. What they found there, unfortunately, was that now that it was being struck first, i.e. with a fair bit of energy, and therefore was also significantly less supported because being ductile, it could wobble and rebound back outwards after the shell or shot had passed through, the rubber tended to rip itself off of the bolts that were holding it into the hull, and thus at best just fall off and therefore not offer any particular benefit to the ship at all, and at worst partially fall off and now offer either something that obscured a gun port or dragged in the water or otherwise just caused a bit of an issue. In neither case was it particularly good at sealing the shot hole because, well, the rubber plates that had been hit weren't anywhere near the shot hole anymore. And of course, rubber at this kind of thickness was pretty heavy. And so these trials were abandoned. In parallel with the US trials, there were also some other trials looking at both rubber on the face and rubber at the rear of a target, but they found that by the 1850s, going into the 1860s, shot was reaching an energy level, both in terms of size and speed, such that the tear and then reseal effect that had been noted with 32-pounder shot, for example, wasn't really present with 68-pounder shot and similar. Those would tear through the rubber, but thanks, again, in part due to the size of the shell and in part due to the energy, rather than tearing a slit in the rubber, it would just take a big chunk out of the rubber and carry that along with it, which left an unsealable hole in now a big lump of rubber-based product which you'd stuck in, which now was offering you zero benefit. So ambitious, theoretically, with a marginal benefit at the very, very beginning of its testing period when we're talking about purely wooden warships armed with 32-pounders, but by the time it was in any kind of position to actually be seriously implemented, technology had moved on to a point where it was just completely ineffective and therefore rubbish. And finally, we're going to come on to the Jeune École. This is a system which has had a reasonable amount of talk and feedback on the channel before, but I thought it definitely belongs in this kind of video. So for those of you who are unaware, the Jeune École fundamentally was an idea, unsurprisingly given the name come up with by the French, but adopted by a variety of other navies, which held that if a navy was too small or its industrial base was too weak to compete with a much larger, more powerful navy, specifically in this case, obviously France, compared to Britain in the latter part of the 19th century, it should instead focus on two major areas of warfare: a commerce raiding cruiser fleet and a torpedo-heavy small craft attack fleet. The idea being that commerce raiding cruisers were smaller, faster, and cheaper to build compared to big, heavy armoured cruisers, and the torpedo boat was obviously vastly cheaper to build than a battleship, but a torpedo boat could sink a battleship, and even if one of them couldn't, well, you could build several dozen for the cost of a battleship, and one of them was certainly going to get a hit. And so for a price that was considerably less than your opponent, who presumably was building a big full-spectrum battle fleet, and for an industry that would therefore not have to have the major implications of a slipway, graving dock, dry dock system, armament system, etc., to fit out the latest and greatest battleships, the biggest thing they'd have to build would be a cruiser, you could counter an enemy battle fleet considerably larger than your own. Plus, of course, with torpedo boats, they were quick and easy to build, so even if you sustained quite heavy losses in your first battle, as long as you inflicted some losses on your opponent, you could regenerate your force within a few weeks or months, whereas there was no real way an enemy battle fleet was going to get a whole bunch of new battleships into its fleet in anything less than a few years, unless they had some battleships building immediately before the war broke out. And of course, any individual loss of a torpedo boat resulted in far less loss of experienced manpower. You could have a small defensive battle fleet if you wanted, but it wasn't, strictly speaking, necessary. The other element of the whole thing, as we mentioned, was a commerce raiding cruiser fleet, and they would go out and disrupt enemy commerce, thus cause economic damage, and this would split the enemy's attention, because of course enemy cruisers were the natural counter to your torpedo boats, but if they kept all their cruisers near their battleships to protect them from your torpedo boats, then their commerce would be destroyed, and then they wouldn't have any money, so they'd be forced to surrender. But if they sent their cruisers out to deal with your commerce raiding cruisers, well, ideally your commerce raiding cruisers would be fast enough and numerous enough to give them the slip, but even if they gradually ground down your commerce raiding efforts, during that time, your torpedo boats would attack the enemy battle fleet and destroy it, and with all their big battleships sunk, they would be forced to seek terms. So why was it a bit rubbish? Well, fundamentally, the Je n'Ecole fell into one major trap. There are a few other smaller ones, but the single biggest trap was one that a huge number of weapon systems and tactics, both naval and land and air, fall into on a disturbingly regular basis, and that was simply it assumed that the enemy would only ever build what it was currently building before you enforced a change paradigm on them. So in this particular case, it assumed that the British would just continue to build big cruisers and big battleships because that's what they were building at the moment. But it turns out that if, to use a modern term, you introduce disruptive technology into a, in this case, naval warfare scenario, the other side has a vote as well. So they're going to look at your disruptive technology, tactics, whatever it happens to be, and go, okay, is this actually a threat? For Britain, of course, a fleet of commerce raiding cruisers was a threat, okay? And, okay, yeah, torpedo boats could potentially sink battleships. Right, so we actually do have a problem. Step one. Step two, how do we solve this problem? Are there counters that we can put in place? And it turns out, well, yes, there are, because expanding a raiding cruiser fleet wasn't really introducing a new idea. It was just putting a lot more emphasis on something that had been part of general warfare for a very long time. And so the Royal Navy knew exactly what the counter to that was. Well, if there are enemy commerce raiding cruisers, then you have commerce protection cruisers. And these might be roughly a similar capability to the commerce raiders, but more often they would be somewhat bigger and somewhat meaner, more guns, more armor, not necessarily quite as fast, but then they didn't need to be because they were the ones on the defensive rather than on the offensive. If they were fast enough to chase down and deal with the commerce raiding cruisers on account of being significantly larger or something like that, then great, but it wasn't a be-all and end-all. You could have a wide range of cruisers for commerce protection. And when it came to torpedo boats, there were several answers. There was install secondary and tertiary and essentially anti-torpedo boat batteries on your capital ships. Because, okay, fine. And 1870s-early 1880s battleship doesn't have a huge amount of secondary firepower, and what it does isn't particularly fast firing, because it's designed, if anything, to help set on fire an enemy battleship. But now that there is a good reason to cover your battleships in small fast-firing weapons that can put down small fragile torpedo boats at great speed, well, turns out a big battleship is relatively easily able to carry them, and it's not actually that expensive to install. You can also build cruisers, more cruisers that is, and perhaps even build cruisers that are optimized to deal with torpedo boats. So essentially taking a similar kind of armament to what you're now sticking onto your battleships as secondary, tertiary, etc. batteries, but just put it on a cruiser, which is obviously a bit faster, a little bit more expendable, and put them as a fleet screen. And of course you can also build your own torpedo boats to take out what limited capital ships your opponent has. And, well, you might as well stick a few guns on your torpedo boats because they're fast, they're agile, the same as the enemy's torpedo boats, so they can hunt down and destroy their opposite numbers on the other side. Now, you might be thinking, well, hang on, Drac, building a whole bunch of at least well-protected, well-armed, and possibly very big, very fast commerce protection cruisers, and a bunch of anti-torpedo boat cruisers, and your own slightly larger, more heavily armed torpedo boats, and upgrading the secondary and tertiary batteries of your battleships, or in some cases inventing those batteries out of whole cloth, surely that's all very expensive and would require a huge amount of industry. Well, yes, but the whole point of the Jinnicol is that you are facing exactly that kind of enemy, so they can by default afford it, and when they do so, they're going to start building those things in very large numbers, which you can't match. And suddenly, not only have they mirror-matched you, they've outmatched you. They still have that big battle fleet, which was the original problem. And now your fast attack fleet, essentially, is pretty darned ineffective at solving the original issue, which is, well, they might sail up to your ports and shoot them, or they might just sit there and blockade you. And the whole strategy falls apart. And that was essentially what happened to the Jinnicol. People realized that any strategy that involves relying on small, fast, cheap, easy-to-build solutions could just be overmatched by the bigger opponent going, cool, I can do that, but more. Now, combining the commerce rating and the torpedo element with sneakiness, resulting in the submarine, did potentially seem to offer an avenue whereby a variant on the Jinnicol might win through. However, that ran into the same problem of, well, if you're going up against a bigger, more technologically advanced, potentially, but certainly more industrially powerful nation, they can and will invent counters, and then they will spam them like there's no tomorrow. So although the German U-boat efforts in World War I and World War II did do considerable damage, for example, to British and then later Allied shipping, Britain turned around and invented anti-submarine technologies and built large numbers of escorts, and eventually the U-boat threat was contained. Now, there was one time when a fleet managed to use a vast number of torpedo-armed attack craft to cripple an enemy's commerce, as well as sink a significant number of their warships, and cut off their supply lines and make their life very difficult in terms of both operating their ships and actually feeding their population. However, that was the US submarine offensive in the Pacific in World War II, and that was a case of the bigger industrial power just going, lol, control C, control V, I have all the submarines, and sending them against the smaller power, which ended up just kind of reinforcing the point, which is, yes, in theory, mass commerce warfare can work, but it almost only ever works when you're the bigger power in the first place. It's just a slightly more casualty-averse way of doing things, because although, yes, submarine crews do tend to go down with all hands, except in rare circumstances, the simple fact is that 50 to 100 men on a submarine is a lot less than 800 to 1,000 men on a cruiser, or several thousand men on a battleship. And battleships and cruisers obviously being somewhat less stealthy, if you throw them into the mix, they can be attacked constantly by all the enemy assets. Submarines somewhat harder to target in those manners, but again, mostly a product of the sheer industrial strength of the United States. You'll note that the Japanese weren't able to leverage their fairly capable and considerable submarine arm to do anything like that level of damage to either American commerce generally or American supply lines. So there's my pick of five ambitious but rubbish naval ideas. Let me know in the comments below what you think are some ambitious but rubbish naval ideas, remembering the criteria that they have to, at least on paper, have made a certain degree of sense before the implementation was tried and found to be somewhat lacking.
That's it for this video. Thanks for watching. If you have a comment or suggestion for a ship to review, let us know in the comments below. Don't forget to comment on the pinned post for dry dock questions.